This is Oklahoma Perspective. The COVID-19 virus has been labeled a worldwide pandemic by the World Health Organization. As the number of cases grows in the United States, the challenge for the Food and Drug Administration is to respond quickly with a vaccine. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Dr. Roger Klein about the challenges the FDA faces to find a vaccine for the coronavirus.
You were advisor to the FDA, to the CDC, looks like CMS, HMS, and former medical director of molecular pathology at the Cleveland Clinic. You run an interesting article in the New York Post, and in it you talk about how the FDA regulates testing, and especially new test kits for new viruses or new diseases that come out, and how it may have been mishandled in the case of the COVID-19 virus. Can you talk a little bit about what you're saying here?
Yes. So historically, FDA has not regulated clinical laboratories in hospitals. And what's happened here is the agency's basically prevented hospitals from setting up tests for the coronavirus. Now, in 2009, during the H1N1 epidemic, hospitals stepped up to the plate, set up tests. We tested lots and lots of thousands of patients, and we quickly understood how severe the disease was and how widely it was spreading. And we had information that could directly manage the patients who we saw. And this time, FDA restricted hospitals, wouldn't allow hospitals to test, and gave CDC the right to make a test and to basically control testing. So you had a public health laboratory, which is really geared toward epidemiology, setting up a test, distributing it to other public health laboratories. They're not hospitals. These aren't clinical labs to take care of patients. They're public health labs. That's different than a clinical diagnostic lab to take care of patients. And then, of course, we had some issues with the CDC's CDC actually ended up manufacturing kits. So now we have the federal government becoming a kit manufacturer, and there were problems with them, and labs couldn't use them, and we fell way behind in testing. And we had countries like South Korea that had tested 100,000 cases by last week, and we had done a total of 472.
And this was a direct result of basically, what, over-regulation? What was the FDA's logic
Absolutely.
Behind doing it this way? Why were they preventing hospitals from doing the testing?
Well, you'd have to ask the FDA that, but they're still doing it. And I received an email from a friend of mine at a major institution, and basically he said, I'll give you some quotes. Quote, we need to be able to bring assays on back. We need to be able to bring assays online under CLIA, not FDA. Back in 2009, under CLIA, we were able to develop, ramp up, and meet needs quickly. Due to the regulatory blank with the FDA, X will not even accept an LDT application for COVID-19. So then he closed it with saying it's pretty stressful here this week. So what we're saying is we have people who are highly skilled professionals who want to set up testing in hospitals, but who the federal government, the FDA, is preventing from setting up tests for their patients.
So let's back up for a second. CLIA, the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments. Can you explain what that was and how that impacts this?
So CLIA was a law that was set up in 1988, and there's been subsequently regulations issued under it, under Medicare, under the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which regulates clinical laboratory testing in the United States. And there's a series of sort of layers of regulation involving accreditation and then states. And what's happening is that FDA has encroached upon that paradigm, is treating the hospitals like manufacturers, stepping in and then prohibiting them from offering testing. Now, the administration came in and said, well, we need to broaden this, and FDA said, well, we'll issue what are called emergency use authorizations, which they give to device manufacturers in an emergency, and they said they'll issue these to labs. But Maya, from what I'm hearing, they're being very tough, and this is causing a lot of problems for people. And really, who's suffering but the patients and the society? And in Washington State, University of Washington was ready and able to go with the test weeks ago. They went live last Monday. They can test 1,000 people a day. This dwarfs what the public health labs in that state can do. Yet they were prevented from offering their test. And who knows? You know, the virus was circulating there for weeks. Maybe we could have stopped the outbreak in the nursing home that's killed, you know, over 10 people.
So let's talk a little bit about COVID-19, which is the disease that this novel coronavirus causes. It is obviously a viral infection. It is flu-like in its symptoms. And when we talk about comparing it to the flu, how do you assess that in terms of, you know, A, impact on patient, how bad is it? How serious is it if you get this disease? And B, I know it's very early on, but how easily is it transmitted to other humans? And how deadly is it if someone was to get it? I mean, these are all open questions at this point, but I'm sure there's a little research getting done.
There is research getting done. We track these numbers carefully, those of us who are following it. And you're right. So you know, as a virus per se, you know, the chemistry of it, they're not the same. We don't have to get into that. But functionally, they're similar. They're both respiratory illnesses, which means you contract them, and they primarily act on the respiratory tract, the breathing tract, the lungs. They both exert their worst symptoms primarily through pneumonia. And they're similar in that they're spread through droplets. They're both spread through droplets. So the diseases have a similar mechanism of spread. They have similar symptomatology, and in some ways we can look at them if we step back, you know, as functionally similar. So what we can say about the flu, because we have lots of experience, is that We understand what the death rate is, and, you know, we look at aggregate death rates, and it's pretty low for the flu, but, you know, there are people die from it, and elderly people in particular are at risk. And if you look at society at large, this flu is pretty contagious. We have 40 million people a year infected and potentially 60,000 people dying. So flu is actually a major public health problem. Coronavirus, this new COVID-19, we only have 552 cases so far. So you're comparing 40 million to 552. Big difference. Here, the death rate, because of that nursing home, most of the deaths have been in that associated with that nursing home, is running about 4%. But I think if we look at broader experience with the disease, and we look at places, for example, like South Korea, where they're doing lots of testing, and they've been doing lots of testing on a wide range of people, we see the death rate is less than 1%, significantly less than 1%. They've got early cases in there, so that could rise. What's happened, though, is the people who are tending to get tested are those who are sick and sickest. And CDC's criteria, for example, are very heavily biased toward the sickest patients. So when you test the people who look the worst, the disease is going to look worse. If we start testing, and once we start doing widespread testing, and we start testing people, for example, who are contacts of those who have the disease and who don't display symptoms, we'll start to get a very, very different feel for it. But already we can say that for younger people, most people in general have a very mild illness. It's the death rate seems to be very low for young people, you know, say 40 and under. And in general, most people, other than people who are elderly, and especially those over 80, and those with underlying illnesses, It's looking very much like a flu. This really looks like kind of a bad flu. And I think the people who are sick or who are elderly are at higher risk because we don't have immunity to this. We haven't seen it before. So people who are fragile and frail are going to be disproportionately affected by it. But in general, it's kind of like a bad flu.
So with the delay in getting these testing kits created and distributed because they're not allowing the hospitals to do it, there's also, I almost said feverishly, I'm going to find another adjective. They're urgently working on, a shot, a vaccine. And that's, I've heard estimates from, we could maybe in 3 months have it to, it could take a year and a half. Are the same processes that made the testing process slow in the United States going to slow down the development of a potential vaccine?
They are, but I think, you know, there's justification. If you're going to give a vaccine to somebody, you're going to put something in somebody in contrast to testing them. You're introducing something that could potentially hurt them. And so we're going to have to do testing to make sure that people aren't harmed by a vaccine and that it works and that the benefits of giving it outweigh the risks. And that entails testing on a pretty fair number of people. So we're going to have to do that. And that's probably going to take more time than the creation of the vaccine. Now in Israel, they've come up with what they claim is a method that they can use, that they've used to produce a successful, at least a vaccine that appears to be successful with an animal version of that's similar to this coronavirus. They say that they can use that same method to produce a vaccine for humans, and they believe they can do it very quickly. Well, that remains to be seen, but even if so, I mean, they were listing times of several weeks. Even if that turns out to be true, there's still going to have to be a testing phase before we can widely distribute it to humans.
Right, testing and then manufacturing and then distribution. So really, there's no way to get ahead of the curve on these viruses, which, oh, by the way, tend to mutate faster than we can come up with vaccines for them. Look at the flu, for example.
Yeah, I mean, we can treat them, but treat them ineffectively. So you know, without complete effectiveness, let's say that. And what we do is we give medicines that inhibit their replication, but they still grow, and we don't really kill them with the drugs. We can make the symptoms better. We can shorten the course in some cases. And we have drugs in trial already. We'll probably have drugs that will be useful. I think in general, though, it's just as with other viral infections, we'll build immunity, from what we can see, and we already have well over 100,000 people affected. Again, the most severely affected have been the ones who are tested. We're seeing that in immunocompromised people, elderly people, or sick people, it presents a significant risk. So, you know, still, most people do okay, even in those categories. End up surviving, but I think, you know, we're getting a picture of a virus. You know, we've seen other bad viruses. This is not Ebola. This is not something where a high percentage of the people who get it die. It's the opposite. Most people get mild disease. There's probably many people walking around this world who have symptoms of a cold that are infected with this coronavirus. And in fact, there are coronaviruses that cause colds in humans.
Right. This is related to the common cold virus. It's not the same, but it's same family. Is that fair to say?
The same type of virus. Again, the same class of virus. If you want to say what it's related to SARS. It's more closely related to the SARS virus that we experienced here in the early 2000s. Now, in that case, the difference is that was not readily transmissible. That proved to be relatively difficult to contract, and but much more deadly. So that It was about 10% of the people who got infected with that died. I saw that as a resident at Yale when I was in training. I saw the first suspected SARS patient in Connecticut. He ended up not to have it, and we only had 8 people test positive in the United States. This is easier to contract. That the World Health Organization has suggested recently that it may be less transmissible or less contagious than the flu. WHO suggested it's more deadly. Their numbers indicate that, but again, they're biased numbers. And if we break it down by age, we see most people have a mild illness. It certainly doesn't present any. It doesn't appear to present any. A significant threat to young people. It's mostly the elderly and the sick in whom this would is more likely to cause serious problems.
All right. Well, listen, this is interesting stuff, Doctor. Now, we were told Friday that the state of Oklahoma had received kits from the CDC. They tell us in a standard 8-hour day they can test about 100 people. As far as we know so far, there have only been maybe 10 or 12 tested and 10 more pending, something like that. The numbers shift continuously, as I'm sure you understand. But we do have a confirmed case here in Tulsa County, a gentleman who had gone to Italy and returned, apparently having been exposed. So, you know, obviously everybody is talking about it. And yet, when I was out this weekend, I was at a couple of different events and there were a lot of people out. So, you know, we're trying to weave between, you know, making sure that people understand it is a potential threat to health, but at the same time, it's not a death sentence. Right. And trying to get that to people, and prevention, obviously, once again, is the key, because as you said, we can't cure it necessarily, but we can do quite a bit to prevent it.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, the flu is a much greater risk for most people. So they should wash their hands. They should sanitize. They shouldn't touch their face. We should stop shaking hands. You shouldn't get close to people who are coughing or sneezing. And if you yourself are sick, stay home, please, so that you don't give it to other people. But the truth is, coronavirus probably isn't circulating, at least not in a significant way, in your community. And you're more likely to get the flu. And all of these measures will help protect you against both diseases, but against one that we know will potentially kill 40 or 60,000 people this year. You made the comment about the kits, and presumably the public health lab is getting CDC kits, and 100 tests a day may seem like a lot, but it isn't if we saw an outbreak. And what's happening is the doctor has to take the step to send this to a public health lab. It's probably going to take days to get it back. If people go into a hospital and they send this off and they don't have the coronavirus, they're going to use up a bed to isolate this person. They're going to put the person in isolation because they suspect it, and they're going to be essentially wasting resources that may be needed in the future. If, for example, University of Oklahoma is allowed to set up testing, they can go ahead and they can probably ramp up to test many, many more patients, and they can turn it around right away. It might take hours.
Which would prevent them from filling up, you know, isolation beds in hospitals with patients that don't need to be isolated, essentially.
You'd be able to make a diagnosis quickly. And we know who has it and who doesn't. So who's at risk and who isn't? Once we have testing available, and it's available locally and people can order it, you might say, well, okay, my father had coronavirus, and I saw him yesterday. I'd like to be tested too. And if it's there and it's readily available, people will do it, and we'll get a handle and an understanding on both the transmissibility and how widely it's spread. And also we'll see people who have no symptoms and have the disease, and we'll get a better understanding of how serious it is. It's things like when H1N1 came out, everybody thought it was horrible. We greatly overestimated how bad it was. And then once we started testing thousands of people and we saw it progress, we realized it wasn't any worse than the ordinary flu, and now it's just a regular circulating flu just like all the other flu.
Dr. Roger Klein, special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interview. This is Oklahoma Perspective for Cox Media Group. I'm Bert Williams.